Lancashire Constable of Hampshire Constabulary, which, if you don't know it, is the most fabulous police force in the whole of the UK. We have three cities, we have a forest, an island, an international airport, two international seaports, a test cricket ground, and a Premiership football ground. So you couldn't design it any better. Fantastic. Nationally, I have a couple of other responsibilities. I'm introducing the National Police Air Service, and you can be very thankful that you're not going to be sitting here for the next 45 minutes about helicopters. I have the ACPO, Association of Chief Police Officers, lead on out-of-court disposals, which is relevant to what we're going to be talking about. And I've recently become the ACPO lead on futures. And futures, I guess, can mean whatever you want it to mean. But definitely an element of futures is thinking on behalf of the association about how we will work over the next 3, 5, 10 years. What are the challenges facing us in terms of economic change, population movements, changes in crime, changes in technology, changes in organisational approach? And I'm trying to map those things. And I've reduced the future down from a sort of vision of 20 years away to the Olympic period, to 4 years' time, and what can be delivered over that 4 years. I'm very happy to be here. I love coming back to Cambridge. I studied here 3 times, and eventually, through my persistence, I was given a certificate if I didn't come back again. I love coming here. And I have tried to invest in some of the best people in my organisation by sending them to Cambridge to allow them the opportunity that I was given several years ago. There's probably a slide somewhere. If I press the button, would appear on screen. Might say something about the role of a chief officer, reducing crime, for example. The Police and Crime Commissioners will start in November, and some of the people who were thinking of standing as Police and Crime Commissioners in Hampshire came to see me, and one of them asked a really good question. How do you choose what approach to take when you've got a problem? Why do you do what you do? And of course my answer sounded a bit like, well, because we've always done it like that and it seems to work. Or because we saw someone else using an approach somewhere else and that seemed to work. Oh, and sometimes because what we're doing is based on evidence. And then I reflected on the proportions of those 3 answers. And because we've always done it that way, it's about that much. And because we saw it happening somewhere else and it seemed to work, it's about that much. And it's based on evidence that we know it's going to work because we've got the data and we can support it, is about that much. And it wasn't a particularly good question. So I gave some very wise advice and he was shortlisted out and is no longer going to be mine. So the point is, we need to understand what really works, not what we think works or has worked quite well since 1829, and let's do that by applying some academic rigour, and why not involve the University of Cambridge, because they're really, really good at this sort of stuff, and we're really good at dealing with risk, so you combine the 2 things, actually you might get a good result. We go on to the next slide, which we've done. There might even be mention of risk at the bottom, and my appetite for risk. It seems to me, unless we address the issues such as people who go missing and young children who are at risk and victims of domestic abuse, then we're going to miss a whole great chunk of what our people actually deal with every day and what society expects from us. We can play in the easy territory, that's fine. Let's get into the risk areas, because that's where we spend a huge amount of our time. That's where we have to find the right result, because if we don't, quite literally, people die. So this is the area I want to be in. There are risks that come with it, described in the wrong way. This looks like we're taking a creative and imaginative approach to something that's so serious that you really should never mess around with it. And the answer is always get in there and arrest someone and take them to court, because it's so serious. We take a slightly more sophisticated approach, partly based on studies of previous years, Professor Sherman's being one of them, that says there might be different ways of addressing domestic abuse that isn't necessarily just arrest and off to court. But there is some risk attached to this, and an example of that you'll hear, we had to get the agreement of the Home Secretary, the agreement of the Director of Public Prosecutions, and both of whom have conversations with the we've had conversations with me about this experiment, about this pilot in recent weeks, and asked how it's going. So it has a currency and it has a level of risk that is recognised at a national level. However, if you want to take on something risky, then you choose really good people to get involved with it and to see it through. And I chose some really good people, and the university have supported these people and this project. And Robin Jarman was one of the first people that I sent up to Cambridge in the newer form of the course. And Robin was the person who came up with the idea, and he will now explain how he did that.
I'll try this mic, it might be slightly better than that one. Okay. Before I begin, it's an opportunity for me. I've recently retired from Hampshire Constabulary, and I'd just like to say thank you to Mr. Marshall and to Larry Sherman for the opportunity to come here and study in what was the twilight of my police career. Hampshire didn't pay, by the way. It was a scholarship from the university. Thank you very much. So what did we do? We went on to... I was a former head of criminal justice in Hampshire Constabulary for my last 4 years, which probably placed me in an opportunity, having built relationships across the criminal justice system in Hampshire and beyond, perhaps to have that confidence to consider how we could address something on a broader basis across the agencies rather than just in-house. So in relation to domestic abuse, a lot of you will be very familiar with those quotes up on the screen there. But I think it's the scale of the reporting of this, really, that was brought home to me in my studies here. And I think a quote from Larry Sherman was, it's just the tip of the iceberg in relation to what is going on across our country day in, day out. And then really to consider its impact and what the police were doing. So historically, many of you will recall that... this area of life was untouched, really, by policing. For many, many years, it was a private matter. And it wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s, that it really began to get some voice, particularly from feminist groups, and become a campaign issue, which eventually led through to government action. And what we have today, of course, the positive action policy, which all forces will be following across the UK, of take some action. And invariably, that leads to arrest. I think Hampshire's figures are something like 70%+ of incidents attended by officers lead to an arrest. But the consequence of that is that people are brought into police custody, and what we're seeing is that it's all about prosecution. That's what the policy is about. It's the Holy Grail. But in 2009, nationally, over 10,000 victims retracted their statements after charge. Now, when you consider that means victims, offenders, the criminal justice system, just what sort of impression was that delivering? What was the cost of that? Let alone, was there any benefit being achieved from that process at all? And I think it was something that also was just discovered when we looked at it from a local criminal justice board point of view, was that there was a real high attrition rate right across the board, an awful lot of no further actions coming from high arrest rates. And there was also, contrary to ACPO guidance, an increasing use of the simple police caution. Hampshire in 2009 issued 1,500 simple police cautions for domestic violence offences. And indeed, research was also suggesting a huge amount of victim dissatisfaction, and actually that the criminal justice system and those working in it were really not in accord with victims' wishes. They weren't interested in punishment. They just wanted the offending to stop and to build the relationship. So it was that conflict, really, that got me interested into, is there an alternative way forward here, particularly in relation to our usage of conditional cautioning, perhaps? Our problem with the conditional cautions, when it was issued, was that domestic abuse incidents were not allowed to be considered for conditional cautions. And fortunately, Mr. Marshall agreed, along with the head of the Crown Prosecution Service, that they would like to see if it was possible to run a trial in this area. So a letter was sent by Mr. Marshall to the DPP requesting permission to run a randomised controlled trial supervised by Cambridge University to add that academic rigour with a view to seeing if there was a better way of dealing with the volume of cases that are being faced. So that was the question that was posed, and we eventually got a letter back approving the trial in the way described. Unfortunately, the area was curtailed. We weren't allowed to really stray into the prosecution side of things, which was quite frustrating. It was made very clear that we were to hone in around the simple police caution area, and also that we considered options around addressing offending behaviour. So how did we go about that? Well, during the spring and summer of last year, a multi-agency steering group was created under the auspices of the Local Criminal Justice Board. The chair of court services chaired those meetings. And I pulled around the table the key players, really, in the local area that had the necessary experience and position and status in their worlds to contribute to the development of a proposed way forward with the randomised controlled trial. It was an interesting period. We eventually brokered that agreement, and that was signed off in September of last year. My thesis last year was all about the feasibility of running the randomised controlled trial, and knowing that Scott was following me up as in his first year, I handed the baton over to him to actually implement. So I'll pass you over now to Scott to see how he's got on.
Okay, thank you. I think firstly I have to acknowledge the work that Robin did, the groundwork, the difficult negotiations of getting to the point where the DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Home Secretary would actually agree to a trial on such a sensitive and emotive subject. Running a randomised control trial in a police organisation for me requires a number of things. One of those is somebody with a good idea, which Robin had in conjunction with Cambridge University. The level of support and supervision of a university like Cambridge with the pedigree that that brings, because that certainly assists your negotiating power with other stakeholders and people that allow us to do these type of things. A chief constable who gets it, supports it, and is interested in what you're doing and takes that visionary look. And then you need people on the ground that can run a randomised control trial in an operational environment and understand not only the context of what they're doing, but some of the mechanics and mechanisms of what works, what doesn't. It can be done, and Joe Rowland, who is taking it to the next stage, will discuss where we're going with that, and I will mention also a research post that I think is invaluable in terms of making this happen. So, foot on the ball, where did Rob leave it with me? Agreement was made to run a randomised control trial on domestic abuse cases dealing with the issue of conditional caution. That meant that we were no longer going to issue simple cautions for persons arrested for low standard or medium domestic violence incidences. And what we would do is we would send half of that group of people that get arrested and are eligible on a two-day workshop, two separate one-day workshops, where their offending behaviour would be discussed and diversionary advice and guidance put in place, and another group of people that in effect had a sword of Damocles. If they re-offended over a four-month period, they would go to court for the original offence. So the trial was very much an intention to treat, so what we were looking at is not necessarily the content of the workshop and the mechanics of how that worked and what worked within that. It was the process up front that allowed us to have a treatment group and a control group in very, very strict conditions where we'd maintain the internal validity and we'll be able to present some findings. So I picked up in October and a number of months went by where negotiations continued. The hypothesis is up there on the screen for you to read. The reality was a huge part of my work initially before we actually designed the methodology was engaging the organisations and keeping the victim focused. There was an array of different views around how victims would respond to this and how victims would feel as a result of this treatment. Similarly, we had to design a process that operated within the current legislative framework and the processes of the Crown Prosecution Service and the police. So it's not easy, but through a stepped approach and a bit of hard work and a lot of negotiations and discussions, you can remove some of those barriers that people may perceive exist. Key people in this, lots of meetings with the Home Office, discussions with MOJ, Ministry of Justice, but I cannot emphasise enough the value of spending time with the sort of third-party stakeholders, Women's Aid, Rape Crisis, Respect, the organisation that provide accreditation for the national courses to address domestic violence offending behaviour. Without that, you would not be able to introduce something that some people could see as a little bit radical and a little bit dangerous without them understanding the processes that you've gone through to design the experiment the way that you have. Communication is really important around giving it a clear branding and people understand what you're talking about, and I'll mention that in a moment. Now, one of the things that Robin did and the Chief Constable discussed prior to me taking over was where are we going to do this. My day role is as the area superintendent for crime and operations for Western Hampshire, which is a third of Hampshire. What that provides are a number of benefits. It's got a big city like Southampton with a diverse population, both in terms of cultural and different nationalities. It's got the New Forest, which is a rural community, and the different complexities that that brings. And it's got what I would call the urban environment. It's got Eastleigh, Romsey, where the airport is, the motorway links. So you couldn't design a better place in which to run an experiment. The other advantage of holding it in Western area was I could use my team to make this happen. So my detective inspector would run the custody investigation team that deal with all of these cases. I could use my own communications manager to help me with some of the difficulties that we had. So we were operating and designing an experiment within a controlled environment. But in the back of my mind, I know that we could have done this in the Eastern area, we could have done it in the Northern area, we could take it to another police force and we could do it similarly there. Building a team. This isn't a big project with lots of people sat in a room. This is around having a good research manager. We've got Robert Braddock here, who is the full-time research manager who was seconded from his day job to work on this, who has been invaluable in making this happen. The detective inspector in the custody investigation team, he deals with the people and the cases. Jo, in her role as head of criminal justice, did the interaction between the local criminal justice board and how this all fitted into the wider issues of alternative methods of disposals, and an individual within the public protection and safeguarding team, and myself. That was it. Not full-time. Do your day job. We can make this happen. Rob Braddock was the only full-time person that worked on this. So it's essential. Identify an area. Identify a team. I'm not going to go into all of these. It's a complicated business. There's bits of law, there's bits of guidance that we needed to work within so that we could go back to the Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer, for him to actually amend his guidance so that you could issue a conditional caution as opposed to a simple police caution. Very simply, the way it works, person gets arrested for an offence, gets brought into the police station. The team, the custody investigation team that process prisoners on spontaneous arrest, they deal with the case as normal. They gather evidence as normal. They then present the case to the CPS, and the CPS agree that it meets certain criteria, the eligibility criteria. And therefore, at that point, we enter it into the Cambridge Randomizer, which some of you will be familiar with, a piece of IT software, which will allocate the case either to the workshop group or the non-workshop group. And then what we do is various other processes follow where we get people to attend the workshop and bits of paper and things are given out to understand it. Data collection, Joe might pick up on this later, I would like to. The data collection, we designed this experiment to test that hypothesis. But what we've done is we've set up a system where we are capturing a degree of pipeline data around domestic violence from point of arrest through to out-of-court disposal, where we've got to any one time, any one day, we can say how many people have been arrested, what sex they were they employed, were they not, did they re-offend, if so, what for. It presents opportunities to do some more work with the data, but a very systematic approach and some careful thought came into how we might be able to develop this work further. So, the offending workshop, the really sensitive and emotive point here. People going on a workshop in 2 days for domestic violence, that sounds daft. That's, you know, this isn't driver awareness, this is a serious issue. And this is where the legwork went in. Who did we select as a provider to do it? Well, that was dead simple. There's not many people out there that can do it. So we scoped what was out there and we worked with people that were used to working with offenders, the people that deliver your IDAPT programs, your 30-week programs to deal with offenders. But what we said was, we're not trying to change, we're not trying to provide therapeutic counselling to offenders, we're offering diversionary approach. So we're highlighting for offenders the consequences of their action and their impact of their behaviour on their families, their career, and what it might mean for them. We don't profess to do anything more sophisticated than that. That worked. The funding that was needed for that was relatively low cost in the grand scheme of things, and it was approved by the local Criminal Justice Board. Various chief constable chairs it and various leads come together, that it was the right thing to do if we're going to make a difference around domestic violence. The issue of public perception was the carefully negotiated issue with women's groups and how we might actually answer those difficult questions around, is this a soft touch? Well, it comes back down to people were going into a police station, sometimes receiving a simple caution, and that was it. There was no way of safeguarding the victim. These are lower end offences for domestic violence. We don't deal with the high risk areas. The work there's a bit of work to do with training staff. We had to develop guidance manuals in conjunction with the CPS. It all sounds very difficult and time consuming. It's not if you've got people bought into the process, and they're never perfect and you need to test your processes. So what we've done from March up until recently is test the process in a dry run, in effect. We've still been sending people on the courses, but we've been ironing out all of the processes, and Joe will mention around going live next week what that means for us. I'm not going to claim anything other than state the facts. At the moment, people are turning up at the workshops and they're not reoffending. Nobody has, as yet, has reoffended as a result of being on the workshop. And we will see, that's the whole point of testing whether it works or not. Big concern was that people wouldn't take this seriously, they wouldn't go and we'd have to breach them straight away. Well, at the moment, it's not looking like that, but we'll see over the next year or so. So, where are we now? We are just about to randomise permanently to both groups. We're already collecting all of that data. We know what it means. We've got the breach processes working, so the few people that haven't engaged in the process have already gone to court. And the governance will continue as it is now. OK. I will hand over to Joe Rowland, Head of Criminal Justice, who's taking this experiment to the next phase, and we'll explain what it means in a wider context.
Thank you. When the chief said to me he's going to send me to Cambridge and give me a ready-made randomised control trial, I thought, brilliant, I'm home and dry, I'll get this done. And then Scott came along with quite a to-do list. The to-do list had a lot on it, we've narrowed it down, and it started with, you just need to engage some stakeholders. The stakeholders being people like the Home Secretary, the Director of Public Prosecutions, no pressure. But I started to understand, actually, although an awful lot of work's gone into the randomised control trial already, an awful lot of work needs to stay keeping the stakeholders where they are. Because this is a pipeline study, we're not going to be in a position to produce data tomorrow, the next week, the next week. And so for stakeholders, they can have a period of silence, and we need to make sure that they are still on board with the project right the way through. So one of my main tasks throughout the leadership of this next stage will be to keep those stakeholders on board. The thing I need to do is make sure the service provision is up to scratch. We've got the service provider, the Hampton Trust, providing the workshops. whilst I won't be in a position to say whether they're effective until the trial is producing some evidence, I do need to make sure that they are reliable and our procurement around them is going to be sustainable and they are delivering as contracted. So that's going to be one of the other areas I visit. The other thing, through the tutor of Heather, I am going to look at the power of the experiment. Have we got enough cases to make this statistically significant? Do we need to take it to another area of the force, or do we need to give it longer to get more cases through? So that's a conversation that I look forward to having. Now I actually understand what statistical significance is, and Larry would be pleased to hear that I do, I think. So, analysis. Analysis, obviously, we've got the main analysis around the rates of offending. Do those that have gone on the workshop have fewer instances of reoffending than those that have not? I am very lucky to have the aforementioned Rob Braddock, affectionately known as Bradders, to work all that out with us. But we're also hoping to get an awful lot more data out of this study, the demographic data, the impact on the criminal justice system as a whole. Did we see a decline in other types of disposal? How did the officers find it? Was it bureaucratic? And most of all, has it got the foundation of some policy? Will this produce the evidence to show that this could be a policy that can be replicated? We also need to have some consideration for the victims. What was the victim experience of this disposal? It's a really, really difficult area because we don't want to keep going back to victims months later when perhaps their lives have moved on. But at the same time, I think they've got a story to tell. And whilst this workshop is offender-based, we do need to make sure the victims are involved. So to briefly summarise, because I'm probably as hungry as all of you are, this randomised control trial is made possible because of the number of people that have backed the idea that Robin first came up with. In the police service, we have an awful lot of change, we have an awful lot of projects, and I think all of us of a middle management or senior leadership position deal with change projects as part and parcel of our daily business. Adding just a small amount of academic rigour around those change projects, we can start to use that to build an evidence base as well. It doesn't have to cost a lot. This has cost no more than tens of thousands. It's not hundreds of thousands. It's certainly not millions. And actually, because it is a part and parcel of day jobs, a lot of the costs are not added costs to the constabulary at all. It does require the key staff. We have praised our individuals in the corner, but it does require the commitment. And most of all, it does require that strategic commitment. And I think we are very, very lucky that Cambridge University are supporting us. But I think there is a lesson here for other chief constables to take the risk with projects like this, put the academic rig around it, and hopefully we'll get the evidence base. Thank you.
I would just like to add a coda to this from the point of view of Cambridge and the collaboration we've had with Hampshire Police. And as you can see, this is probably as close as ever likely to a model of collaboration between researchers and operational partners. This has really been a wonderful experience for the people at Cambridge, and I hope a happy one at the other end as well. And of course, it's been very nice to have the enthusiasm that is engendered by having this wonderful generational aspect to the succession of Hampshire officers. Three of them so far being able to take part in this from the Cambridge end as well as from the local end. One successful master's thesis, another one on the way, and no doubt another one from Joe next year, so that they are each able to employ data from the experiment at each stage as the basis for their formal master's thesis. A couple of points. I think, and those of you who heard me speak yesterday, I'm really saying the same thing again. I think that Hampshire's willingness to employ a dedicated research manager has been absolutely crucial in the smooth way in which this very demanding project has unfolded. This is not a simple intervention. It's, of course, required a huge amount of sign-off. This is probably the most hot-button subject in criminal justice. Lots of sensitivity, lots of parts of the Cambridge, the Hampshire Police involved in different stages of processing these cases. The kinds of issues that arise when you have to move between agencies. And CPS has had a crucial role in all of this. We have needed their cooperation. We have needed to consult with them to an enormous extent to get this right. But the fact of having a field manager on the spot has, I think, just made all the difference. And Rob Braddock, I don't know if he's in the room, but he is definitely the hero of the hour, top left. I don't know whether Rob ever wondered what he was going to do each day, but I think that there's no question that he is one of the most fully employed people in Hampshire today. There is just so... there are so many pieces of this and so much ground to cover and so much coordination and communication that's necessary. All the measuring, all the monitoring, all the chivying and nudging that is part of getting an experiment off the ground, Rob has really had a huge role to play there. I want to mention two things in particular about the way in which this experiment design finished up. I think from a purely academic standpoint, I myself, but I shouldn't speak for others, but I would have been happier probably to test the new conditional cautionary against the old simple cautions, because that is in effect what has happened, that there are no more simple cautions, more or less, for this kind of offence in Hampshire. We have stepped it up to, or Hampshire has stepped it up to, conditional cautioning under the arrangements agreed with the Home Office and the DPP. There isn't good theory or evidence about the style of intervention, these workshops that you've heard about, which is in this scenario the experimental condition. But of course, we all have to accept that it was politically unacceptable to do the sort of thing that you might have done in another universe, and that is to compare the existing treatment with a new treatment. And only this kind of comparison between two ways of doing conditional cautioning was really feasible. But there is another consequence of this that I'd like to mention, and that is, the possibly unanticipated consequence of replacing simple cautions with conditional cautions, because conditional cautions are what they say. They are conditional. They must be cases that CPS judges could be sent to court, and if they were sent to court, that there would be a good case there in terms of the evidence. And so there is an essential element of this process, which is that for each case coming into the experiment, the CPS has to judge that the evidence is sufficient for a successful prosecution. Now, the unanticipated consequence of this may be that there are far more NFA cases at the end of this experiment than there was when the simple caution disposal was available. These cases all have to meet a higher standard of evidence, obviously, than a simple caution. What are you going to do with the ones that don't meet that standard? Well, we haven't got a simple caution anymore. So there's a lot of NFAs. My recollection is that this part of Hampshire has around 40 domestic abuse cases they're dealing with each week. And at the moment, we are having around 4 of those declared eligible for this disposal. Many of them, of course, are too serious to come into the experiment. They would not ever have been treated as suitable for caution. We now have very few cases that are ostensibly eligible being rejected by CPS. That's all to the good. That has been the product of a very valuable and necessary bedding down period, what you might call the dry run, the phase one, and all of those issues have been brought to light during that period and have been satisfactorily dealt with. So we now can be fairly confident of what the case flow will be. We know we need around 300 cases. We know we're getting about 4 a week. So we're very much on top of the question of case flow. But as Joe says, it may be that it would be preferable to open it up to another area so that we could get the cases quicker. These are the sorts of issues that might come under discussion. And finally, I think that one of the great strengths of the way in which Hampshire has decided to conduct this study is that we have a wonderful database being developed, an extraordinarily rich database that relates to all of the domestic abuse cases. Whether they are ostensibly eligible for this experiment or not, we know about all of them. And that's just going to be immensely valuable. This is an area of criminal justice about which much is asserted and really very little known. And this bigger database, as it were, all of the cases that we know are not eligible for the experiment but which come under the rubric of domestic abuse, this is just going to be a fabulous data set to work with. And just to close, I can only say that this is the greatest bunch of people to do business with, and it's just an absolute pleasure for the Cambridge team to be collaborating with them. Thanks very much.